Wow. Edge. There's my answer to my question. Is there edge today? I was asking Debbie, I'm thinking, this is fifth Sunday. Is that still a tradition? Obviously not, because they're on their way out. Have a great day, youngins. Well, there we go. Now I'm ready. Warning signs are everywhere, aren't they? What do you do when you see a warning sign? Drive faster? Okay, pay attention, Wade says. That's probably a very good suggestion. Sometimes it might be just trying to tell us there's a rough road ahead. Maybe pay attention because it could get a little rocky. And you certainly wouldn't want to speed up in that condition. And sometimes it's because there's a serious situation. You know, and I had to think about this sign a little bit. Touching wires causes instant death. Who cares if there's a $200 fine if you aren't there to... So again, you wouldn't pay attention to it, would you? I don't have to listen to that. Well, that brings up another one. You know, some signs are for our benefit. You know, trucks reduce speeds. I don't know, Phil, do we ever have to pay attention to that when we're testing people about their driving? I know we had a route up in Meadville where we'd come off of 79 always on those ramps, and you know, you'd pay attention to how fast people would hit those, whether or not, you know, you're going to mark that off as being a bad thing or not. But I got a question for you, Phil. You don't have to answer this. What are those yellow signs? What's that? Cautions. Warnings. We call them in the law. I was a driver's license examiner, as you've already figured out. We call those advisory. It's good advice. The white signs, when you disobey them, they cost you money. Those are regulatory. But these are advisory. See the difference? So we don't have to pay attention to this one, do we? Well, I can tell you, when you haul dog food out of Dad's and you run Route 6 all the way out to Pierpont, Ohio, you go out 6, there's some curves on that road. And if you don't pay attention to those, when you get up to Holland, Michigan, most of those pallets in that trailer, you've got to restack them on that pallet because it spread them all over that trailer. And that guy ain't going to unload them unless you restack them. You learn a lesson in a hurry because that sign meant what it said. Kind of like this one. This guy figured out real quick that I should have slowed down. I remember these in Oklahoma City. Going from I-35 onto I-40 East, there was a pretty good ramp up around. And I remember one time a truck going up around there loaded with tar, upset. Not only got that road, but it got the road below it. I've seen that happen too with milk. I don't know, Jeff, does milk slosh around? Would it get a little tippy if you went too fast around a curve? Yeah. You know, now when you got a milk truck upset, all you get's a bunch of cats. You don't have to get the cleanup crew out there so quick if you got lots of cats. But that's a pretty good sign too. Too often we ignore them, and we ignore them to our peril. Well, God sent Israel some messengers. David talked about them this morning. You know, what are messengers? Well, they're prophets. And a prophet isn't necessarily predicting the future. That's what we seem to think. Prophets predicted the future. They're actually saying, turn or burn. I'm trying to warn you, there's a curve ahead. If you don't slow down, if you don't pay attention, this is going to hurt. And people wouldn't pay attention, then it would hurt. Oh, look there, he foretold the future. That wasn't his purpose. His purpose was to tell you what God was trying to tell you. And that's what these guys were doing, trying to give people a little advance notice of the fact that they're getting in trouble with God. And again, just like the truck driver, too often they ignored God to their peril. The Bible is arranged topically rather than chronologically. I always like, when I do my annual Bible readings, I like to pick out a chronological reading because I like to do the Bible in order. But that ain't the way it's put together. It's put together topically. And we see in the Old Testament there's the history. There's the law first. And then there's the history. And then there's poetry. And then there's prophecy. So that's the order they fall in. But in this week's lesson, we saw that put together chronologically, and it deals with the prophets Elijah and Elisha, and it also deals with Hosea and Amos. Now, Hosea and Amos are way back there after Kings. I mean, that's considerably later in the topical Bible, but they belong right at the same place as this story. So they're listed together in our lesson this week. The Chronicles also, though they are printed later, overlay this period, as does Ezra, Esther, and Nehemiah. They're all the same period of time, but because they tell topically different stories, they're at different places in the Bible, but they're all covering the same period. I really like the way the story, and that was its purpose, was to give us a book to read that was much more friendly to us, that we would read it like a novel and we would be able to do it. So the story does give us that advantage. And never think that it's just a storybook, because it's the actual scriptures printing together in that book. So you can have a little confidence in the book that you have before you. And we sang already last week, we dealt with 1 Kings chapter 16. And it dealt with Israel being divided. There's the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And of course we saw in that division, Jeroboam had taken Israel in the north, and Rehoboam was with Judah and Benjamin in the south, and that caused a separation. And Jeroboam, all worried about his power and control, he wanted to make sure people didn't go down to the south, because the more people hang out with one another, the more they get to liking each other, and they might just leave him, and he might lose some of his power. So he made up some systems. He made up some new rules, a new sort of religion. He gave a substitute for the truth to keep people happy. Well, 6 kings and 40 years after Jeroboam, we read that Jeroboam, his evil continues. So he planted something evil, and we see that in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 29, and I got to find 29 here. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel, and Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. So we see that Jeroboam did a good job of passing on his evil ways, because here we are a number of kings later, 40 years actually, and 6 kings later, and he's still doing evil, only now it's worse. Says worse than all those have gone before him. And Ahab as an evil king, idolatry is out of control during his reign. Worse, another problem, his wife, the lovely Jezebel. Now, I want to say, not a Jezebel, but the Jezebel, if that means anything to you. I mean, she's like the arch evil one. Jezebel's problem is she worships a god named Baal. And she wants a temple built to worship her god. And amidst this backdrop, God sends his messenger Elijah. And his number one message is turn from idolatry. Now, why would he say that? Well, idolatry is people's number one sin. The first two commandments address it. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, and thou shalt make for thyself no graven images. I mean, this is important to God. He doesn't want us doing it, and he gives some warning to that effect. Well, I know what you're thinking. I'm glad I don't have that problem. Well, or why do we waste so much time on such nonsense? I have no star carved statues. I don't bow down to any images. Or do I? Any confessions? No, you don't have to go there. I'll go there. I can guarantee you, I probably have some, and I suspect you probably do too. Well, I'm not probably, I know I have some. For one, somebody has surmised, well, maybe saving for retirement is more important than giving to God. That'll be important to God that I'm well taken care of in my retirement, right? I can't afford to give to him now. He said, the things you spend your time and your money on tell what you value. And sadly for many, it isn't the things of God. Maybe just money itself we worship. Well, there was a guy named David Clarkson. Now, I know there's a guy named Clarkson over in England, and he's got a farm. And he's a famous race car driver, and he drove Lamborghinis on the highways. But he also has a Lamborghini he farms with. He ain't the Clarkson I'm talking about. I don't know why I brought that up, other than I watch that guy and I like him. Then there's another Clarkson that sings on TV, and she's been, what, a voice star and a very successful person? That ain't who we're talking about. And I'm betting you don't know David Clarkson because he was a 17th century Puritan preacher. And he asked some questions in a sermon that should serve as a test of what people worship. Are you ready to take that test? Okay, good. What are you most disappointed with? Speak loudly. What disappoints you the most? Who? Health? Health? Okay. Any others? Self-discipline. Okay, that's probably a good one. Well, let me explain that another way. What do you complain about? Because that tells you what you're disappointed with. You complain about your career, your finances, your marriage, your sex life. What we complain about the most is what disappoints us, and disappointment is driven by what you've staked your hope upon. That isn't working out the way you wanted it to, so you complain. The old hymn, Christ the Solid Rock, starts off with, my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. Wow. Listening, it's all around. If we truly believed that, we'd be content. But this world is filled with discontentment. Many people's lives demonstrate that. The second question is, what do you sacrifice your time and your money for? A person's checkbook, register, or their bank account, or their Quicken program, or whatever they keep track of all their money on, their bank statement, their credit card statement, is a great indicator of what they worship, because it tells you where they spend their money. Luke in chapter 12, 34 says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. How many treasure Jesus above everything else? I got to tell you, it's not showing. I see a lot of worship of things, activities, and people a lot more than God. Even at my own address, like I said, at my house, I don't stand up here and preach at you so much as I preach it myself, because I'm a good, bad example. So, you know, when it says to be a great disciple maker and disciple people, I hope we learn that we're discipling people to follow Jesus. They'll naturally follow you, but I hope you're showing them by following Jesus yourself. Because that's the best example that we can make. Anyhow, a lot of people show that they love their things more than they love God. Number three, what do you worry about? How often do we worry about how we're going to protect our stuff? See how we keep coming back to stuff? The insurance industry represents billions of dollars, much larger than the church. Do you say, if I lost it, or if I lost this, or if I lost that, I simply could not go on? Or do we get an insurance policy to cover the loss so that we can keep our stuff? Or at least keep the value of our stuff. Jesus says in Luke chapter 12, why do you worry? If God cares about the flowers of the field and the birds of the air, how much more will he care for you? It's a good question about anybody who worries. You know, God's going to look after stuff. All of your worrying, you know, you can't add an inch to your height. You can't add an hour to your life by worrying. In fact, worrying's more than likely going to cause enough stress to shorten your life and to keep you from growing. But still, we do it. We stress about what we have little control over instead of worshiping Him and trusting Him. Well, question number four is, where do you go when you get hurt? When life is hard, when you need comfort? A lot of people turn to food. Do you know why that is? There's a class of food we call comfort food. Now, I meet with a bunch of elderly people. Let me be nice about us. On Friday nights to play cards, but we start off by eating. And Chris Baxter can down a lot of food. And the next morning at breakfast, he'll complain about eating way too much. Because we all love comfort food. You know, the problem with it is you eat it enough, it makes you so comfortable, you want to take a nap, not sit there and play cards. You know, there's the problem. That's why we call it comfort food. Some turn to alcohol. Some turn to drugs. Some turn to pornography. Some run to media groups, gurus. Is it Oprah? Is it Dr. Phil? Is it Dr. Oz? And the list goes on. There's the media is getting more and more full of experts on about any subject. Where we run reveals where we put our hope. God or something else. Where do you run? Self-question. I'm not asking for an answer. Answer that to yourself. What makes you angry? There's number five in our list. Someone didn't show me the respect I deserve. And that makes me angry. Or somebody jumped ahead of me on the street. Can you believe the way they cut me off? Anger is a control issue. We get angry because we feel we're out of control or somebody's trying to control us. But if you surrender, boy, there's a word Tim used to love, wasn't it? He used that a lot, and there's a lot of reason for it, because we need to surrender. When we give up control of our lives and surrender it to God, it should not anger us, because you never really were in control. If you can acknowledge that fact, God is in control. Well, number six. What brings you the most joy? Pleasure is most often substituted for joy, and we look to someone or something else to bring us pleasure or joy. But joy is a state of mind and heart produced by the Holy Spirit. I think I heard Jeff say that this morning. Someone else cannot provide it. God does through His Spirit within us. Only God can, and there's nothing more joyful and fulfilling than being loved by God and knowing that you are right in the middle of what God made you for. What has God made you for? Find out and get busy doing it, and you'll never be more joyful in all of your life. Well, number seven, and this will be our last self-test question. Whose applause do you long for? Whose approval matters most to you? Are you living to please these people? It could be a parent. It could be a spouse. It could be an employer, or a coach, a group of peers, or a certain guy or gal. You're on a road to depression, because that is an impossible task. You're never going to please everybody. Live to please God, and you'll receive the only approval that matters. And when He tells us, you shall not make yourselves any graven images, He's talking about idols. What's the definition of an idol? An idol is anything or anyone other than God who gets the passion, the hope, the glory, and the commitment of your life. And just like Jeroboam, it's a cheap substitute for God. And I can give you an example. Brand name products. Now I can tell you this meant more to me 10 years ago when I wrote this sermon. Yeah, I've had this one around for a while. I used it somewhere else one time. But brand name products used to be a big deal to me. If it was Heinz or Hunt's, it was okay. But if it was some other ketchup, don't put it on my table. I don't like cheap substitutes. Not Carolyn. Cheap is the name of the game. And generic is just fine. But it isn't the same. But with time, I've learned to like cheap substitutes. One, because the substitutes have really gotten better. Actually, most of the time, it's the same product in a different bottle. It's just cheaper to buy. But you're getting the same stuff, so you haven't lost any quality. And for the other part, if I want something better, I got to go pay for it myself. And there are a couple of things I go pick up, and we have, but, you know, for the most part, cheap is just fine. Because most of what you've got out there is some pretty good stuff. But it's that way with God for many people. Our culture force feeds us cheap substitutes for God. Well, at this point in the story, we find that Israel had settled for a cheap substitute for God in worshiping Baal. And good old Queen Jezebel is running him down their throats. So God sends Elijah to say, there's going to be a famine. Now we might say, what does that have to do with idolatry? But that is simply because we don't understand the context. You see, Baal is an ancient Egyptian god of the weather. Specifically, the god of thunder, the god of storm. He's thought to ride in the clouds. To remove the rain is to challenge their god. So God says, I'm going to withhold the rain, and he will withhold blessing in their lives, specifically in the area where we place our worship, where they place their worship and their hope. And they were putting it in Baal. So, we shouldn't substitute either when he withholds blessing in an area where we fail to trust him. Where we trust our own efforts and desires, he simply will not bless his competition. We may ask God to bless us in areas where we find security and identity, like our success in our careers. Maybe we ask him to bless us financially so our family can feel safe, secure, and happy. Areas of need that God is supposed to provide for us in our safety and our security. But the very thing we want most, he withholds because we don't simply trust him. It's the safety, the security, and the happiness, and the success and money that we trust. He isn't going to bless misplaced trust even when we ask in his name. He can see right through our self-centered request. He will teach us to trust him. That is exactly what he does in the story. They're worshiping the god of the rain, so he withholds the rain. Let your false god fill your need, he says, and he will teach us to trust him. And that's exactly what he does. After 3 years without rain, that's a long drought. Elijah sets up a match to show who the true God is. 1 Kings chapter 18, if you'd like to follow along. Verse 18 to 21. We read that, and he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but you have in your father's house, because you've abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. They say nothing. God does not answer. And he says, you got to choose. But he tells the prophets of Baal to go first. And we pick that up in verse 25. Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first for you and for many who call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it. Then he took the bull that was given to them, and they prepared it, and they called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and there was no answer. And they limped around the altar that they had made. At noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, cry aloud, for he is God. Either he is musing, or maybe he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. And they cried aloud, and they cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out from them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. Now I know what we think. We think, how silly. How primitive. But we're not all that different, are we? Cutting themselves and trying to appease Baal, but we do the same thing. It's just that our gods are different. We sacrifice for money, for food, for alcohol, for drugs. We sacrifice a marriage for sexual pleasure. We'll sacrifice relationships for social media like Facebook, another cheap substitute. Well, nothing happens, and now it's God's turn, and we pick up in verses 38 and 39. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offerings and the wood and the stone and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord is God. Now it says they all bow down and worship. They realize who the true God is. And they cannot even make it back to town from the mountain before they are soaked in rain. And God blesses them. Idolatry isn't just offensive to God. It hurts him. It's like having an affair and being unfaithful to him. Some of you know all too well what that pain of that form of betrayal is all about. Later, God uses the prophet Hosea to make that very point. He commands him to marry a prostitute. As they might guess, or as you might guess, she's repeatedly unfaithful to him, and God tells Hosea to buy her back. On more than one occasion, he does this. It seems hopeless, but it's a demonstration of his love and sacrifice for us. You see, this is the upper story application of the lower stories on faithfulness to Israel. God does that for us. Like the loving husband, he pursues us like an unfaithful bride. His love for us is so great that he's willing to pay the greatest price to get us back. And as the person of Jesus Christ, he gives his very life's blood on the cross of Calvary in payment for our souls. Is there anything between us and God? If there is, we need to give it up. To repent and to turn back to God. If you want to talk about to somebody about your relationship with Jesus, well, you can come down as we sing our invitation. David's here, Carl's here, I'm here. We're all willing to talk to you. And if you aren't sure of that commitment, then get with me before even leaving this place today and we'll get together and talk. But whatever it is separating you from God, now's the time to give it up. In the midst of Elijah's story, God speaks to him in a gentle whisper. That's the way it is with Jesus. He won't compete with the loud voices of the world. He calls us softly and tenderly.